"Hello? Say there, sir?" The voice echoed over Mallory's head like the cry of a bad conscience. He glanced up, startled. From a third-floor window of Jackson Brothers, Furriers and Hatters, protruded the black barrel of a rifle. Behind it, Mallory made out the balding head of a spectacled shopping clerk, leaning from his open window now to reveal a striped shirt and scarlet braces. "May I be of service?" Mallory called, the phrase emerging out of reflex. "Thank you, sir," the clerk cried, his voice cracking. "Sir, could you please have a look at our door there? Just to the side, below the steps? I believe there may be someone hurt." Mallory waved one hand in reply, walked to the shop's entrance. Its double doors were intact but badly battered, dripping splattered eggs. A young man in a sailor's striped blouse and bell-bottomed trousers lay sprawled there, face down, a pry bar of forged iron near his hand. Mallory seized the shoulder of the sailor's coarse blouse and turned him over. A bullet had taken him through the throat. He was quite dead, and his nose had been mashed to one side by the pavement, giving his bloodless young face a bizarre cast, so that he seemed to have come from some nameless country of sea-going albinos. Mallory straightened. "You shot him dead!" he shouted upward. The clerk, seeming rattled, began coughing loudly and made no reply. Mallory spied the wooden butt of a pistol tucked in the dead sailor's intricately knotted sash. He tugged it out. A revolver of unfamiliar make, its massive cylinder curiously slotted and grooved. The long octagonal barrel, underhung with a sort of piston, stank of black powder. He glanced at the furrier's battered door. Clearly an entire mob had been at it, an armed mob bent on the worst kind of mischief. The wretches must have scattered when the sailor had been shot. He stepped into the street, waving the pistol. "The rascal was armed!" he shouted. "You did well to—" A bullet from the clerk's rifle screamed off a cement stair-step, bleaching it white with impact and narrowly missing Mallory on the ricochet. "God blame ye, you cack-handed fool!" Mallory bellowed. "Stop that this instant!" There was a moment's silence. "Sorry, sir," the clerk cried. "What in hell do you think you're doing?" "I said I was sorry. You best throw away that gun, though, sir." "The hell I will," Mallory roared, slipping the pistol into the waistband of his trousers. He meant to demand that the clerk come down and decently cover the dead man, but he thought better of it as other windows rattled up on their casters, four more rifle barrels appearing in defence of Jackson Brothers. Mallory backed up, showing empty hands and attempting to smile. When the fog had thickened around him, he turned and ran. Now he moved more cautiously, keeping to the centre of the street. He discovered a trampled cambric shirt and cut its baggy sleeve loose with the small sawtooth blade of his Sheffield knife. It made a serviceable mask. He examined the sailor's revolver and plucked a blackened cartridge case from the cylinder. It still held five shots. It was a clumsy thing, foreign, unevenly blued, though the mechanism looked to have been executed with a decent degree of accuracy. He made out Ballester Molina stamped faintly on the side of the octagonal barrel, but there were no other markings. Mallory emerged on Aldgate High Street, recalling it from his walk with Hetty from the London Bridge Pier, though it looked, if anything, more eerie and horrid than it had in the middle of the night. The mob did not seem to have touched it as yet, in the inherent vagary of chaos. A rhythmic clanging of alarm sounded from the fog behind him. He stepped aside to watch a fire gurney steam past, its red-painted sides battered and dented. Some London mob had brutally attacked the firemen, attacked the trained men and machines that stood between the city and mass conflagration. This struck Mallory as the acme of perverse stupidity, yet somehow it failed to surprise him. Exhausted firemen clung to the gurney's running boards, wearing bizarre rubber masks with gleaming eyepieces and accordioned breathing tubes. Mallory dearly wished for such a mask himself, for his eyes were misting so painfully now that he squinted like a pantomime pirate, but he tramped on. Aldgate became Fenchurch, then Lombard, then Poultry Street, and still he was miles from his goal, if the Palace of Paleontology could be said to be one. His head pounded and swam with the sullen lees of bad whisky and worse air, and he seemed to be nearer the Thames now, for a damp and viscous taint arose that sickened him. On Cheapside, a city omnibus had been toppled on its side and set afire with its own boiler coals. Every window in it had been shattered, and it had burnt to a blackened husk. Mallory hoped no one had died inside it. The smoking wreckage stank too fiercely for him to want to look more closely. There were people in the churchyard of St. Paul's. The air seemed somewhat clearer there, for the dome was visible, and a large crowd of men and boys had collected among the churchyard trees. Unaccountably, they seemed in the highest spirits. Mallory perceived, to his astonishment, that they were brazenly tossing dice on the very steps of Wren's masterpiece. A little farther on, and Cheapside itself was blocked by scattered crowds of eager and determined gamblers. Fairy rings of rascals had sprouted left and right from the very pavement, men kneeling to guard their mounting stakes of coins and paper money. Eager leaders in mischief, tough, squint-eyed cockneys who seemed to have leapt whole from the coagulated stink of London, cried aloud hoarsely like patterers as Mallory passed. "A shilling to open? Who'll shoot? Who will shoot, my lads?" From the scattered rings came cries of triumph at winning, angry groans muffled by masks. For each man boldly gambling, there were three who timidly watched. A carnival attraction, it seemed, a stinking and criminal carnival, but a London lark none the less. There were no police in sight, no authority, no decency. Mallory edged warily through the thin, excited crowd, a cautious hand on the butt of the sailor's pistol. In an alley, two masked men booted a third, then relieved him of his watch and wallet. A crowd of at least a dozen watched the sight with only mild interest. These Londoners were like a gas, thought Mallory, like a cloud of minute atomies. The bonds of society broken, they had simply flown apart, like the perfectly elastic, gassy spheres in Boyle's Laws of Physics. Most of them looked respectable enough by their dress. They were merely reckless, now stripped by chaos to a moral vacuity. Most of them, Mallory thought, had never seen any event remotely like this one. They had no proper standards left for judgment or comparison. They had become puppets of base impulse. Like the Cheyenne tribesmen of Wyoming, dancing in the devil's grip of drink, the good men of civilized London had surrendered themselves to primitive madness. And by the patent look of surprised bliss on their shining faces, Mallory perceived that they enjoyed it. They enjoyed it very greatly indeed. It was exaltation to them, a wicked freedom more perfect and desirable than any they had ever known. Along the edge of the crowd a line of gaudy handbills had been newly slapped up across a formerly sacrosanct brick wall of Paternoster Row. They were adverts of the cheapest and most ubiquitous kind, the sort that pursued the eye all over London. Professor Renbourne's Magnetic Headache Pills, Beardsley's Shredded Codfish, McKesson and Robin's Tetralethine, Arnica Tooth Soap, and some theatrical prints. Madame Scaplioni at the Savile House in Leicester Square. A Vauxhall Panmelodium Symphony. Events, Mallory thought, that would surely never come off. And indeed the sheets had been posted with a careless haste that had badly wrinkled the paper. Fresh glue dripped from beneath the bills in rivulets of white ooze, a sign that perturbed Mallory in a way he could not define. But slapped amid these mundane bills, as if it belonged there by right, was a great three-sheet broadside, a thing the size of a horse blanket, engine-printed, rumpled in the hasty plastering. Indeed, its very ink seemed still damp. A mad thing. Mallory stopped dead before it, stricken by its crude bizarrity. It had been done in three colours, scarlet, black, and an ugly greyish pink that seemed a muddle of the two. A scarlet blindfolded woman, a goddess of justice, in a blurry scarlet toga, brandished a scarlet sword labelled Lud over the pinkish-grey heads of two very crudely rendered figures, a man and a woman depicted in busts, a king and queen, Lord and Lady Byron, perhaps. The scarlet goddess trampled the midsections of a large two-headed snake or scaly dragon, its writhing body labelled Merit Lordship. Behind the scarlet woman, the skyline of London was vigorously aflame in scarlet tongues of fire, while the sky all about the various demented figures was full of stylized scrolls of thick black cloud. Three men, clergymen, or savants apparently, dangled from a gallows in the upper right-hand corner, and in the upper left a confused mass of ill-formed, gesticulating figures waved flags and Jacobin pikes, advancing toward some unknown goal under the bearded star of a comet. And this was not the half of it. Mallory rubbed at his aching eyes. The vast rectangular sheet seethed with smaller images, like a billiard table littered with random pool balls. Here a dwarfish wind-god blew out a cloud labelled Pestilence. There a cannon shell or bomb exploded in stylized spiky fragments, small black misshapen imps being flung aside by the blast. A coffin heaped with flowers held a noose atop it. A nude woman crouched at the feet of a monster, a well-dressed man with the head of a reptile. A tiny praying man in epaulets stood on a gallows, while the hangman, a little fellow with a hood and his sleeves rolled up, gestured brusquely at the noose. More of the smudgy smoke clouds, flung onto the image like mud, connected the whole business like the dough of a fruitcake. And there was text, too, near the bottom. A title in large, smudgy engine type. The Seven Curses of the Whore of Babylondon. Babylondon. Babby what? What curses, and why seven? The sheet seemed flung together out of random chunks of engine imagery. Mallory knew that modern printers had special printer's punch cards, clacked up to print specific blocky pictures, much like the cheap woodcut blocks on old murder ballads. In the engine work of the Catch Penny prints you might see the same hackneyed picture 100 times, but here the colours were hideous, the images jammed hither and thither in apparent madness, and worst of all the broadsheets seemed to be attempting to express something, in however halting and convulsive a way that was simply and truly unspeakable.
"Are you talking to me?"
demanded a man next to Mallory. Mallory jumped a bit, startled.
"Nothing,"
he muttered. The man loomed nearer at Mallory's shoulder, a very tall, gaunt cockney with lank, filthy yellow hair under a towering stovepipe hat. He was drunk, for his eyes were maddened and bright. His face was masked, securely in polka-dot fabric. His dirty clothes were near rags, save the shoes, which were stolen and spanking new. The cockney reeked with days of unwashed sweat, the stink of dereliction, madness. He squinted hard at the broadsheet, then at Mallory again.
"Friends of yours, squire?"
"No," Mallory said.
"Tell me what it means," the cockney insisted. "I heard you were talking over it. You do know, don't you?"
The man's sharp voice trembled, and when he looked from the poster to Mallory again, the bright accusing eyes above the mask seemed kindled with animal hate.
"Get away from me!" Mallory shouted. "Blaspheming Christ the Saviour!"
the tall man screeched, his voice rising, his gnarled hands kneading the air.
"Christ's holy blood, what washed us free of sin!"
he reached for Mallory, Mallory knocking the grasping hand away.
"Kill him!"
an anonymous voice suggested eagerly. The gloating words charged the sullen air like a Leyden jar. Suddenly, Mallory and his opponent were in the midst of a crowd, no longer random particles, but the focus of real trouble. The tall cockney, half shoved perhaps, stumbled into Mallory. Mallory doubled him up with a punch to the breadbasket. Someone screamed then, a high, hilarious, blood-curdling sound. A flung wad of mud missed Mallory's head and splattered against the picture. As if this were a signal, there was a sudden, blinding melee of shrieks, thudding bodies, flung punches. Mallory, shoving, swearing, dancing on his trampled feet, yanked the revolver from his waistband, pointed it in the air and squeezed the trigger. Nothing. An elbow caught him hard in the ribs. He cocked the hammer with his thumb, squeezed again. The report was shocking, deafening. In a split second the melee was melting away from Mallory, men falling, billowing, scrambling away headlong on hands and knees in their utter beast-like eagerness to flee. Men were trampled before his eyes. Mallory stood for an instant, his jaw dropping in astonishment within his cambric mask, the gun still poised overhead. Then a bolt of good sense struck him. He retreated. He tried to jam the pistol back into his waistband as he ran, but saw with shocked alarm that the hammer was cocked again, the gun ready to fire at any touch of the trigger. He dangled the treacherous thing at arm's length as he fled. At length he stopped, coughing bitterly. From behind him, wrapped in the roiling obscurity of fog, came scattered pistol shots and bestial cries of rage, derision, glee. "Dear Christ!" Mallory muttered, and peered at the mechanism. The devilish thing had cocked itself automatically, channeling part of the powder blast into the piston beneath the barrel, which shunted the grooved cylinder back against a stationary ratchet, spinning the next round into place and kicking the hammer back. Mallory hooked both thumbs over the hammer and worked at the trigger with care until he could close the mechanism. He slid the pistol back into his waistband. He had not outrun the line of pasted handbills. They still ranged before him, apparently inexhaustible in number, slapped up one after another in a ragged line. He followed them through a street now seemingly empty. From somewhere came a distant crash of glass and whoops of boyish laughter. "Secret keys made cheaply," said a plastered bill. "Handsome waterproofs for India and the colonies. Apprentice chemists and druggists wanted." Ahead he heard the quiet clop of slow hooves, the squeak of an axle. Emerging from the mist, then, the bill sticker's van, a tall, black wagon, its towering sides mounted with great shouting billboards. A masked fellow in a loose grey raincoat was shoving a plastered bill against a wall. The wall was protected by a tall iron fence some 5 feet distant from the brick, but this bothered the sticker man not at all, for he had a specialised roller device on a kind of long broom handle. Mallory stepped nearer to watch. The bill sticker did not look up, having reached a crucial moment of his work. The bill itself, which was tightly wrapped about a black rubber roller, was pressed and rolled, bottom upward, against the wall, the sticker at the same moment deftly squeezing a hand piston on the shaft of his device, which squirted out a gruelly mess of paste from twin spigots bracketed to the roller's ends. Another swipe downward to complete the pasting, and it was done. The van moved on. Mallory stepped closer and examined the bill, which extolled and depicted in an engine cut the beautifying effects of Colgate's clear complexion soap. The sticker man and his van moved on. Mallory followed it. The sticker man noticed Mallory's attention, and it seemed to rattle him a bit, for he muttered something at the driver, and the van moved on a good ways. Mallory followed discreetly. The van stopped now at a corner of Fleet Street, where the hoardings bore, by old tradition, the great shouting bills of the city's newspapers. But a bill was boldly slapped across the face of the Morning Clarion, and then another and another. More theatrical prints this time. Dr. Bernay of Paris was to lecture on the therapeutic value of aquatic sleep. The Chautauqua Society of the Susquehanna Phalanstery would present a symposium on the social philosophy of the late Dr. Coleridge. And a scientific lecture with kinotropy would be presented by Dr. Edward Mallory. Mallory halted, grinning behind his mask. Edward Mallory. He had to admit that the name looked very well in 80-point engine Gothic. It was a great pity that the speech could not come off, but clearly Huxley, or likely one of his staff men, had placed the order for bills with promptness, and there had been no cancellation. A shame, Mallory thought, gazing at the departing bill van with a new proprietorial fondness. Edward Mallory. He would have liked to keep the bill as a souvenir, and thought indeed of peeling it loose, but the gobbets of paste dissuaded him. He looked more closely, hoping to commit the text to memory. At a second glance, the printing job was not all it might have been, for the black lettering had, here and there, smudgy rims of scarlet, as if the printing pins had been soaked in red ink and not properly cleaned. The Museum of Practical Geology, Jermyn Street, has the honour to present to the London public, for 2 shows only, Dr. Edward Mallory. Dr. Mallory, FRS, FRGS, will present the thrilling history of his discovery of the famous Land Leviathan in Savage, Wyoming, his theories of its milieu, habits, and sustenance, his encounters with the savage Cheyenne Indians, detailing with this the melancholy and hideous murder of his closest rival, the late Professor Rudwick, secrets of professional gambling, specifically that of ratting dens, to be imparted to those eager to know the technique of odds-making, to be followed by the most luscious Dance of the Seven Veils, to be performed by the several Misses Mallory, giving a frank account of their several introductions to the art of love. Only gentlemen will be admitted. Price 2 and 6. Show to be accompanied by the advanced kinotropy of Mr. Keats. Mallory gritted his teeth and broke into a sprint. He ran ahead of the van, which was moving on at a foot pace, and seized the bridle of the mule two-handed. The animal stopped with a snort and a stumble. Its filthy head was swaddled in a canvas mask adapted from a feed bag. The coachman emitted a yell from behind a smut-stained muffler. He leapt down from his wooden seat to land with a stagger, waving a hickory cudgel. "Hello, leave off!" he cried. "Bar that nonsense, Davy, and hook it sharp!" His voice trailed off as he took Mallory's measure, slapping the cudgel against his calloused palm with an attempt at menace. The second bill sticker rushed up from behind the van to join his friend, brandishing his long-handled rig like a pitchfork. "Edge off, mister," the coachman suggested. "We ain't doing you no harm." "You most certainly are!" Mallory bellowed. "Where did you rascals obtain those bills? Tell me at once!" The taller man defiantly shook the paste-smeared roller of his rig at Mallory's face.
"London's wide open today. You want to make a fight of where we dab our paper, then just you try us."